managed to mispronounce last week. Sorry for that. And Paul Williams has emailed from Glasgow to say the internet has transformed his radio listening in many different ways, especially in being able to catch up with Radio 3 via Listen Again. Well, if you've been listening live, thanks for spending this Sunday morning with me, Louise Fryer. Susie Klein will be back with you next week at 10.
Sunday Morning with Louise Fryer is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones. Well, we're back at the York Early Music Festival for our second visit of the weekend in an hour from now. Today, the last ever masque composed for the Stuart Court, John Blow's masque, Venus and Adonis, performed by the Theatre of the Air. That's in the Early Music Show at 1. But now, with the time at midday, time on Radio 3 for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Graham Vick is one of the world's leading opera directors. His productions have been garlanded with many awards, and he's also artistic director of the Birmingham Opera Company. Let's begin, and in fact end, with Birmingham, Graham, because I know it's something that the whole ethos of it is very close to your heart.
Yes, I love opera more than I can possibly explain, and I want to share everything it's given me with as many people as possible. And Birmingham is my way to try and address how we can do that operatically. How we, in the way that we go about operas, how we can find a way of unlocking this form that has a lot of prejudice against it. God knows, people think it's for the rich, it's elitist, it's for connoisseurs and so on. And of course it's not. It's direct, immediate and accessible. So Birmingham is absolutely about opening doors. We perform in non-theatre spaces. We go out into the city and we perform in familiar spaces, in empty factories, empty bank, in an ice rink. We invite people from the city to be part of the show, to act and to sing in it, although we have wonderful soloists and orchestra, fully professional. And above all, I think it's the Wagner thing. In Meistersinger, who is it who decides that the future belongs to Walter von Stolzing? It's the people. The masters don't let him through, and Sax has to trick them into allowing Walter, the new voice of art, the voice of developing, forward-looking, exciting, accessible art, to be taken to the people where it's acclaimed. That's where Wagner reached at the end of his life, not at the beginning. He understood finally that that was the essential voice. And that's what Birmingham's based on. That's what I'm trying to do.
And do you like the juxtaposition? Because your career, of course, still takes you into the major houses. I mean, you're off to St. Petersburg to do Macropolis case. So, I mean, do you like the fact that you come home to this way of working, but still have your other foot, the other side of the proscenium arch, if you like?
The balance shifts more and more and more towards Birmingham in terms of my working process, because the more developed the work there becomes, the more it influences the other work. Obviously, the joy about the work in the great opera houses is working with great artists. That's a phenomenal privilege and constant stimulation. And that I would not want to be without. It's been one of the perennial joys of my life so far, and I see it carrying on.
Well, we're going to move a few miles, a couple of hundred, in fact, north for the first music, and you've gallantly seized the whole point of this programme, which is that it's Private Passions, and therefore Public Passions would be an entire programme of opera. Thank you for not doing that under the circumstances. It means that we can investigate and you can explore those areas of music which mean a great deal to you, but we don't know about so much that's being important to you.
An enormous amount of my personal and inner life has been and is lived through music since I was very young. And I loved making music as a boy. And as a teenager, I used to sing a lot in choirs. I was a lay clerk in Chester Cathedral. And I had a group of friends and we used to sing together. We used to get together and sing madrigals and sing part songs, sing anthems. And one day, my friend Jonathan brought along the Maître Notre-Dame of Machaut, And the minute we started to sing it, I was so, I think turned on is the only real word. I mean, I was so excited and charged by the rawness, by the openness, and also by the space within it for improvised ornaments. We didn't know what we were doing. God knows what it sounded like. But just having a go at it thrilled me, sent a charge through me that I've never forgotten. The pagan glory of this Christian piece, I think, evokes the most amazing world of that incredibly rich King Arthur world where you can have Merlin the wizard walking through the same forest as the Archbishop of Canterbury. It's obsessive and funky, no, and arrhythmic, and it's explosive.
There's a wonderful raw quality to it, isn't there?
Extraordinary, straight from the soul, the gut, the heart, wherever it is. It's very masculine in quite an interesting, rather dodgy way, I think, really. I don't get a sense of great... You can hear great Norman churches or the papal court in Avignon. And you can also... But it's got a wonderfully extrovert quality to its worship. I think that appeals to me a lot.
It's not music that's full of sort of question marks as to where it's going, is it? It has a kind of forward momentum to it.
No, it's from an assured, forward-looking, optimistic age. It's from an age that knew firmly that it was set for greatness, I think. And you hear that splendour in it, that assurance, I think. No, thrilling.
The Kyrie from the Messe de Notre-Dame by Machaut, and we heard the Ensemble Organum directed by Marcel Perez. To Italy next, Graham, and I think a piece that for you sums up Italy in many ways, and of course was also the composer of just about the first opera, but it's not an opera we're going to hear.
No, it's a madrigal. Yeah, well, Monteverdi, one of the very greatest geniuses. Opera started as good as it ever got. But yeah, I chose this because I love it, obviously, but the extraordinary synthesis of words and music is my absolute personal passion. And nobody understood or explored this better than Monteverdi. But also, I love the language so much. I love the sound, the colour. I love what it feels like to speak Italian. I become somebody else. It's a very liberating physical thing for me, I think. So this piece represents a whole, I mean, for me, it's a whole part of my life, I think, that is to do with a culture that I've embraced and that is half my working life I've spent there. But hearing this marvellous intertwining of just two voices and a very sensuous poem, love poem, based around the values of kissing, of the lips and the eyes, basically. But with the simplest of forms, it's the most sophisticated, elaborate, and yet relaxed, sensuous exploration of an idea. So, it's an absolute masterpiece and small. And the other thing that I absolutely love about it is, you know, my life's full of very big music. I do these big operas now. So my own music listening, music making at home, I prefer to be on a smaller scale. When I listen to music at home, it's nearly always of music that fits in my living room. I don't really, for pleasure, listen to a Mahler symphony in my living room. I love to go to a concert. I like going to concerts, that's great. And there are many pieces that I prefer only to hear live, even though I love them and keep them for that experience. Whereas at home, I love the whole idea of the scale of domestic music making. I love the fact of a harpsichord and two singers in my living room, which now, the wonders of sound, is exactly what it sounds like, doing it just for me.
Nella bocca, nella bocca, nella bocca, nella bocca.
It's funny how we both smiled as Monteverdi floated those notes over each other and overlapped them just a few seconds from the end.
It's an astonishing gift because it also sounded so completely inevitable. There's something so amazingly natural and easy about something that is in fact so sophisticated and constructed, that an extraordinary genius, but that easy gestural music making is something that one breathes. It's the other thing that both of us did, is breathed automatically with the shape of the music. Mm-hmm. And the ebb and flow of it is so in tune with natural rhythms. It's astonishing.
Vorrei Bacciarti, from Book 7 of the Madrigals by Monteverdi. We heard Sara Bingardo and Monica Baccelli with the Concerto Italiano, directed by Rinaldo Alessandrini. Graham, I suppose coming from Liverpool as you did, you might have gone into another branch of music, but did you feel any excitement about the buzz that was in that city?
It was a fantastic time to be on Merseyside. I mean, we had, not only we were the centre of the rock music industry, but we had the two best football teams in Europe for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very, very exciting city for 10 years of my youth, followed by an incredibly depressed city in the 70s, in the latter part of my time there, when employment plummeted and when the area turned very dark. My brother's a rock guitarist, and he did it for a living for a while. It was very much in the family. We were very proactive. I played the drums myself for a time, but my path was pretty set for opera very early on.
Well, we return, Graham Vick, to the intimacy, if you like, of a solo piano as opposed to either rock music or an opera house, because it's Chopin next.
Chopin. He himself preferred to play in a salon, didn't he? He didn't like concert halls. Yeah. The scale of the music was in a room. And it's because it's so completely identified. I mean, I listen to Chopin and wish I could meet him. Indeed, I'm sure I'd have fallen in love with him. Again, it's this easy, living, breathing creature is what you feel within every phrase. And this incredibly beautiful piece, the way it shifts harmonically, the modulations are so delicate and yet so compact that in a very short piece, it gives you a very, very deep understanding of a human moment.
There's a wonderfully bittersweet quality to the harmony, isn't there?
Well, bittersweet may well describe practically my entire choice.
Thank you. The Prelude in C-sharp minor, Opus 45 by Chopin, played by Arturo Benedetti Michelangeli. Do you play the piano at all yourself?
Yes, I do indeed. I attempt to play some Chopin.
And does that give you a kind of insight into the music?
I think, above all, it gives me pleasure. I lose myself in it. I'm absorbed in it, and I love that. I think insight, who knows where that comes from or what that is. I mean, I spend my life living on the inside of music. Mm. I suspect if my insight comes from anywhere, it's from singing. It's from the physical understanding and sensation of breath and singing is where I put my musical insight. My piano playing is sheer selfish pleasure. And it's very odd, you know, listening to that incredibly intimate piece. I felt slightly uncomfortable having someone else in the room. And I realise it's part of what that listening, that area is. Is it somewhere quiet and personal and intimate that I go? It's not a shared experience. And I love shared experiences. But I think that's one of the things that I look for in listening to that sort of music.
So it's another version of the bittersweet thing to a certain extent. There's the extrovert and the introvert in a sense.
Yes, I think so. I think that will be right. I think there would be the ascetic and the hedonist as well.
And where do they fit in with Ravi Shankar and Indian music then?
Definitely hedonism, I think. I think definitely hedonism because of the sheer beauty. I love the long-term element of Indian music. This is something that was quite hard. Quite a lot of the music I like is very long term, and so didn't fit the format of the program that well. I love Keith Jarrett, but only if you listen to it for 25 minutes minimum does it work. And so I fascinated at the harmonic and rhythmic complexity, the endless flow of sound within an enormously clear architectural grip that is liberating, so that the playing of the music is always alive and on fire. It's a completely improvised form, and yet within very strongly laid down architectural spans. And to be with Indian musicians while they make this music is a transforming experience. Ravi Shankar created a piece for us in Birmingham years ago, and I've never forgotten the week I spent at his house with people making music all the time in the living room. How daily transporting the experience was.
Don't you think also that rather like people say they have problems with opera or have problems with other cultures, actually, if you just allow yourself to submit to it, to experience it.
Completely. You don't need to know how it's constructed, only to give yourself to it. I think that's completely true of all art forms. Now, you remember Eliot, right, said that even if you don't speak French, you can tell if it's a great poem in French. There is the direct shock of poetic intensity. It will come through. The music, yes, you don't need to understand what it is at all. It's evocative, poetic, beautiful, and it completely compels me, which is one of the things I find it, I suppose, from a practical level, when I'm very anxious, this music will give me a rest. It so engages me on its journey that for the length at least that the music plays, all I know is that music. Maybe my next choice should have been Jimi Hendrix.
The actual sound itself is just so exotic and beguiling, quite apart from the rhythmic patterns and the intricacies.
Yeah, transporting in one phrase, you go somewhere else. But it's also, it's incandescent with life, I think. Just, that's why I said hedonist before, I think. Just the sheer joy of drawing a breath is what I hear in the music. The joy of a phrase, an idea all the time. And that marvellous improvised connection to the life force that's in there is,
Well, appropriately, that was an early afternoon rag, Raga Shud Sarang, Ravi Shankar. Grenvik, you've, I know, had a particularly happy experience with Beethoven's Fidelio at Birmingham. And it is Beethoven we're going to hear now, but we're going back into the chamber world.
Yes, the quartets are works that are very dear to me. Again, it's a scale of music that I can contain and perceive privately. And though I do enjoy very much chamber music concerts, the late Beethoven quartets are something that for years, when I used to have to take music with me before it was all miraculously digital, I always took the late quartets with me on my travels, wherever I went. They were one of a few things that I was never without. And I find everything in them, a rather broad, sweeping statement. But extraordinary, intense understanding, passion, compassion, consolation, provocation, struggle, resolution, all those dualities are alive together within these late works with a maturity that's only actually ultimately. Earlier pieces, they show where it's headed. But almost the resolution is almost unrealistically pure earlier. I think the fascination of the quartets is the consolation it offers is in full recognition of the turmoil and not as an alternative.
And one can't help wondering whether the fact that this music had to be created entirely within the even more chamber environment of his own head, because he couldn't play it back to try it out, and not necessarily that he would have needed to, but that so it actually was a kind of interior world.
There's an interior dialogue of, one hears, of course, lots of dialogue in within the four voices, sometimes two, sometimes three, occasionally even four. But there is a whole inner life going on. That's right. A whole existence happens within these quartets that is awe-inspiring, really, that one man could grasp this complexity and find a way to express it.
There is a feeling in that music of almost desperation at times, don't you think? The kind of dotted rhythm, ba-dum, 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 ba-dum.
Urgency is what I hear. Hmm. Moral urgency, urgency to speak, to communicate. Again, it's a paradox, isn't it? There's the voices that in themselves offer a complete world. How can one be lonely with those voices in one's head? It's a complete existence. And yet, having felt and heard and understood that, how can you not want to communicate it? I think that tension is what I hear.
The finale, the Allegro from the String Quartet in C-sharp minor, opus 131, by Beethoven, the Alban Berg Quartet. Well, now, Graham, you are going to allow yourself a foray into opera.
Allow myself, yes, yes. Well, I thought it seemed perverse not to have any at all. So I decided when I was thinking about all of this, I would do one moment for all of opera. So that at least was easy because it had to be Mozart, the greatest genius, the greatest musical dramatist ever. And then it got much tougher. Because my favourite opera at all is Così fan tutte. I couldn't find part of that that represented everything. So I turned, in fact, to the Magic Flute, to Zauberflöte, to an astonishing moment in the second act when Pamina, having been rejected twice now by Tamino, stands up for the third time at his side to tell him that she loves him. He is about to go through the trials, which hitherto he feels are his trials and his alone. He's excluded her from this journey. Now, the third time, he understands that she is part of the journey. And the extraordinary resolution of how the two of them come together and prepare to set out on their journey. Listen, when the two armed men join them to sing the quartet, I think it is the most sublime creations in all existence.
Thank you.
wonderful achievement, and only sort of three and a half minutes of music, but
a summing up of a philosophy, a summing up of an understanding of life, I think. I mean, the work is both... It's the same, it's been the theme of our conversation, hasn't it? It's bubbling with life and humour and joy and absurdity and with profound seriousness all at the same time. I mean, that Mozart, what can one say? It's all alive all the time. And here, I mean, in those opening two phrases, there's a whole relationship, a whole faith, a whole belief in what a human being is. It's a very, very rich, extraordinary, beautiful moment, I think.
Scene 8, Act 2, from Mozart, Die Zauberflöte. And we heard Evelyn Lear singing Pamina, Fritz Wunderlich, Tamino, James King and Marty Talvola, The Armed Men, with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Carl Böhm. Graham Vick, I said we'd start and end with Birmingham, and that's precisely what we're going to do.
Yes, the last choice has been a kind of life anthem, actually, for me. That's why I put it down. It's the finale from Bernstein's Candide, based on Voltaire. Mm. Il faut cultiver son jardin. Yeah, we must make our garden grow. Mm. When I was at college, I was introduced, I had a wonderful teacher, Elaine Bevis, who taught me so much that I use now and about who I am. She introduced me to this piece then. And when I was at Scottish Opera, I did a version of Candide as a factory show. We took a half-hour condensed version of it around factory canteens at lunchtimes. I did a production of it in Italy, in Italian, for Musica nel Chiostro, which was a marvellous, run by Adam Pollock, a wonderful festival in Tuscany where I did 14 shows and learned how to direct. An incredible privilege. And then finally I did a production in Birmingham, and the piece came home completely, I think, because I think Birmingham's my garden. That's what I'm doing. And I think the modesty of ambition is extraordinary. Lillian Hellman wrote the original book for this piece, and the words that she wrote that begin this, they're very moving, I think. But it's a fantastically stirring piece, and so I chose it as a tribute to all the hundreds and hundreds of people who've joined me in Birmingham.
Chop our wood and make a garden.
Make Our Garden Grow, the finale of Leonard Bernstein's Candide. We heard Robert Rounsville and Barbara Cook leading the company, the original Broadway cast recording, of which Samuel Krechmalnik was the musical director. Well, Graham, thank you very much for introducing us to these choices, which have not been, as you say, exclusively opera, and give a sort of insight into your musical world, your musical garden, in fact.
Yes, in fact, listening to that last piece, it never fails to grab hold of me deeply. I think I'd better go and do some gardening.
Graham Vick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Graham Vick was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next Sunday at the same time, there's another chance to hear choirmaster Gareth Malone talking to Michael Barclay about his private musical passions. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. Today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall.
The tranquil Gower coastline, the rugged hills of Powys, and a thriving market town in the heart of the Border Marches. The Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert visits some of Wales's most beautiful locations as local communities come together to hear some of the UK's finest musicians. The Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert at music festivals around Wales. Weekday lunchtimes, Tuesday to Friday, this week from 1 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio, and you can also listen to us live online. It's 1 o'clock now, time for the news read by Ian Skelly.
David Cameron has hinted that broad government payouts like child benefit could be cut to fund what he described as a refreshingly radical reform of the welfare system. The Prime Minister told the BBC that some universal payments were no longer affordable. More details are expected later of proposals to replace the current range of benefits with a single universal credit. The Conservative conference begins in Birmingham this afternoon. A British soldier has been killed in an explosion in southern Afghanistan. The Ministry of Defence say he was from 1st Battalion, the Royal Gurkha Rifles. His family has been informed. The United States is expected to issue a travel alert later today, urging Americans in Europe to be vigilant and stay away from crowded places. It follows intelligence reports suggesting the threat of an Al-Qaeda commando-style attack on European cities. Voting is underway in Brazil to choose a successor to President da Silva. His favoured candidate, Dilma Rousseff, is widely expected to win, but she needs 50% of the vote to avoid a second round runoff. The Foreign Office has named two of the three Britons killed in a plane crash in Peru. Andrew Brown and Gail Callow, who are both in their 30s, were on a light aircraft which came down near the ancient Nazca lines south of Lima. The third hasn't been formally identified. Delhi is preparing to stage the opening ceremony of the first ever Commonwealth Games to be held in India. The organisers hope it will restore the country's image after the build-up was dogged by concerns about hygiene, safety and corruption. The Prince of Wales will open the Games jointly with the President of India. In golf, play is due to resume at the Ryder Cup in South Wales in around half an hour's time, following more heavy rain. The tournament at Celtic Manor will become the first in its history to go into a fourth day. So what of the weather forecast? Not good if you're used to playing golf in Florida, I suspect. A generally wet afternoon with a band of rain spreading northeastwards. It'll clear most areas by this evening, though rain will linger in the south and east of England overnight. And that's the BBC News and the weather at 2:30 past one.
And it was read by Ian Skelly. Well, now on Radio 3 as part of the BBC's Focus on Opera, here's Catherine Bott with the Sunday edition of the Early Music Show.
In today's Early Music Show, a rare treat. An English opera full of satire and sensuality, first performed at court in the early 1680s with a former royal mistress taking one of the title roles. John Blow's Venus and Adonis stands at the crossroads of masque and opera, looking back to the Stuart tradition of royal and aristocratic participation in this peculiarly English kind of theatrical entertainment, dating from way back to the Tudors. And it also looks forward to the all-sung, through-composed professional opera. It's not as well known as the work it influenced, Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, but it should be. And yes, we're broadcasting this miniature gem in full in a specially extended edition of the show. The performance we're going to hear, recorded at the 2010 York Early Music Festival, was given by Theatre of the Air, directed by one of Europe's leading lute players, Elizabeth Kenny. During rehearsals, I asked her about Venus and Adonis standing at the crossroads between masque and opera.
I think it means that it's the best of all worlds. It has the drama of opera and the really powerful human emotions that go on in that we associate with opera. Also, very importantly, it's sung all the way through. There's no spoken drama at all, as there is in some of the semi-operas or masques of the time. But it also has a bit of the glitz of a masque. It has a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And it's also commissioned to glorify Charles II.
Well, it goes quite an odd way about glorifying him, because one of the first things that happens is that Cupid, played by his illegitimate daughter, Lady Mary Tudor, in the first performance, comes on and says, "You're all a corrupt and dodgy lot, you at court."
But I think because the libretto was written by a woman, Lady Anne Finch, I have a feeling that she could get away with things that maybe male writers couldn't. Because there's a lot about Charles stroke Adonis being a little bit lazy, he can't be bothered to go hunting, and yet all his friends tell him he's very youthful and very sprightly. And there's a bit of a kind of nudge-nudge, wink-wink going on, and Cupid does point out all the corruptions of the court, but also points out that things could be so good if everybody just believed in nature and believed in women, who tend to initiate desire in this piece.
And of course, believing in women is very pointed for the king, because the first Venus, Mary or Moll Davis, is an ex-mistress of his.
I'm Sophie Daneman, and I'm singing the role of Venus.
I'm Giles Underwood, and I'm singing the role of Adonis.
You have a very grown-up relationship, Venus and Adonis. It's not like Dido and Aeneas, is it, Sophie?
Oh, no, not at all. No, we really get a chance to show how much we feel for each other, even in the very first line that we say, Venus, Adonis, Venus. Adonis. It's all there.
Yeah,
it's all there.
It's what the joy of repetition, isn't it?
Yes, what's been and what's to come is all in those, the way we say those words to each other.
Well, there's so much similarity in many ways between the two works. One is much better known than the other, unfairly, in my view.
Well, we were talking about this the other day and wondering whether it was to do with the fact that there aren't any set pieces that you can take out, and that's maybe how a piece becomes more popular, through an aria sung in concert. But in terms of the development of the relationship between the two, and even showing any sort of relationship, which there hardly is in Dido, I mean, you hardly get a chance to understand what it meant before you're supposed to feel terribly sorry for her that it's all gone wrong. Whereas here, there's so clearly a sort of incredibly grown-up and relaxed atmosphere between them. They clearly get on wonderfully well. When her upset happens, it's so much more moving because of the fact that we've had some idea of their closeness.
The fact that they've got a more grown-up, you called it a grown-up relationship, didn't you? It's a physical, it feels very physical, doesn't it? And your outpouring of grief at the very end is...
There's something extraordinary about it. I mean, it's like a sort of primal scream. I mean, it's so modern and so uncontrolled.
Yes, and I always find exceptionally moving the last words of Adonis. Let me on thy soft bosom lie, here I did wish to live, and here I beg to die. And that just brings tears to the eyes.
Absolutely. You get to see what could have happened, what they had planned for their lives together, and it doesn't get to happen. It's timeless, I think ageless.
Let me on your soft bosom lie.
My name's Laura Soper, and I'm playing Cupid in Venus and Adonis.
And playing him very well. But of course the original Cupid was Lady Mary Tudor, so you're meant to be a girl, and you succeed at that triumphantly, playing a boy. This is taking place in a church, this production. It's what they call semi-staged. So here you are now, wearing a most attractive sundress with a flower in your hair. But in the role of Cupid, you're going to wear your school uniform. Tell me why the costume change.
I'm wearing school uniform because we're supposed to be all naughty schoolgirls and boys, but when Adonis dies, I have to look more grown up, as if I've understood the world more. So I change into a pretty dress and walk mournfully.
And is there a moment in Blow's music where you feel that the tone does change and that you begin to understand the world more?
When I call the Graces, after that, everything gets a bit more solemn. Because before, I mess around quite a lot and have a bit of fun with everybody. But after that, it's serious.
Behold my arrows and my bow, and I desire my art to show. No one bosom shall be found ere I have done without you.
One of the most entrancing things about this particular performance was the opportunity it gave to several local children, some of them very tiny, who played the parts of the little Cupids. Tell me about the Cupid's lesson.
Well, this again started out, I think, as a piece of satire. John Blow's day job was teaching the children of the Chapel Royal